as a society, what are some of the strategies we can employ, or what are some of the strategies that have worked elsewhere to prevent or minimize GBV?
First of all, we have to shame the perpetrator, not to shame the victim. This is the first thing that has to be done. We have to accept the fact that when somebody speaks that I was exposed to violence, that we do not blame the victim. We have to unpack the stigmatization about that. Why victims, women or men, do not report? This is the first question. Either because of stigmatization or because of trust in the entities. Therefore, we have to increase the trust in the entities.
Hello and welcome to a very special episode of the Pakistan Experience, because it's quite an honor for us because Dr. Louis Shabane is here with us. He has his master's from Lancaster University in statistics. He has a PhD from Lancaster University. His master's was from University of Jordan in statistics as well. And his bachelor's is in statistics as well from Baghdad. He has been the regional director of UNFPA, the United Nations Population Fund, for all the Arab states. He's here with us today to talk about gender-based violence, to talk about population data, to talk about the rights of the youth and adolescents. But first of all, how are you, sir?
Thank you very much. Alhamdulillah.
I think one of the reasons why I really wanted to talk to you is you're one of the few Palestinians who are in Pakistan right now. And there's a lot of conversation around the role of the United Nations, around the humanitarian crisis that is happening in Palestine right now. But first of all, as somebody who might have family over there, how are you doing?
Thank you very much for hosting me. What's going on in Palestine is very sad. It's very sad for humanity. It's very sad for the United Nations. And it is very sad for the international community. People are dying for nothing. Many civilians have been subject to killing. Women, girls, old people. Self-defense is a right, but there is no right for anyone to kill anyone arbitrarily under any umbrella, including self-defense. The Secretary General of the United Nations was very clear about that. He said that what happened in the 7th of October didn't come out of sudden. And he also said that the situation in Palestine, in Gaza, is beyond what have been witnessed in the last 100 years. So I hope that peace will come very soon and the international community will be able to make enough pressure to save lives of people, women, girls, and old people, and to ensure that humanitarian aid is going with the best ability to serve everyone there.
I think the Secretary General has spoken about it. The Special Rapporteur has gone even further. In terms of your own organization, the UNFPA, the head of UNFPA, Dr. Natalia, has also spoken about the need for there to be unimpeded humanitarian assistance. What do you feel international bodies like the United Nations can do in moments like this? And I'm not sure if you'd want to address this question head on, but are they failing in doing the role that they should be doing in a crisis like this?
Look, the United Nations is an intergovernmental body. It is governed by member states. So if there will be any failure, it's the failure of member states. It's failure of the international community. It's failure of the Security Council who was unable to come together and say stop for killing. So the United Nations is implementing what the member states is mandating it to do. Of course, all of us as development practitioners, humanitarian practitioners, we are very sad that we are unable to extend the support that is needed. We are unable to come up with the promise that we gave to the people all the time, that we will be able to reach people when they need humanitarian support. So the failure is the member states, it's not the United Nations. United Nations is doing its utmost. They are all executive directors, including mine, are trying their best to convince the Security Council to allow them and to pave the way and open the borders so that they can deliver the humanitarian assistance for the Palestinians.
I think to understand the role of humanitarian organizations, multilateral government organizations, maybe Palestine is a good place to start, because the humanitarian crisis in Palestine did not start last month. It's been there for a while. As somebody who was part of the Bureau of Statistics, how important is data in deciding where the humanitarian assistance is most needed, in areas where it quite clearly seems like a humanitarian care crisis has been happening for decades?
There are two layers for this. Let's be very frank. Data is very important, and it decides where to go within whenever the work has been mandated to the UN. But before mandating it to the UN, it is political. For example, all doors were open for Ukraine. All doors, because there was a will to open the doors for Ukrainians. All the doors are closed in the case of Gaza, because the international community, member states, did not want to open the doors. But when it comes to the UN, within the UN system, data is very important, and the work is distributed according to the availability of data. But let's remember all the time that the donors and the funding that's coming to the humanitarian organizations, it doesn't come unconditional all the time. In many cases, we have conditions to work with certain governments, to protect in certain areas, but the United Nations together, they come together, the humanitarian teams, they try to balance and try to make sure that they are able to reach people regardless where they are, based on the actual need and based on the level of the humanitarian aid that is needed.
The question of data allocation is absolutely political. It absolutely depends on political will. But once that bridge is crossed, once the United Nations feels like it does have a mandate for humanitarian assistance, it does have a budget, does the importance of data then become a question of efficiency in terms of how can we use these limited resources that are available to help a maximum amount of people, and those decisions would be data-driven as opposed to being political?
In most of the cases, they are data-driven, but also on the operational side, on the ground, it depends on the will of the partners who are in conflict to allow for the corridors. For example, in Syria, not in order to have what we call it the cross-line convoy coming from Damascus to the northwest, it might take 1 month, it might take one and a half months, it might take 5 days. Depends on the mood of the partners and the parties who are fighting on the ground, and to what extent they are granting the safe corridor. Because the way that UN is working, it works all of the time on zero risk for the humanitarian workers to ensure that they are able to deliver things safely.
If we are to move it to Pakistan, have you found our ability to collect data to be adequate? I was just talking to Dr. Hadia Majid, who is an economist, and she said the fertility rate based on which the calculations were made of economic allocation turned out to be incorrect. The fertility rate in Pakistan was much higher than we had anticipated it to be. So that sends all your projections out of whack as well.
Look, the data system in Pakistan is sound. It has goods and bads. The goods is that there is capacity. There is knowledge. There is methodology. There is history of collecting data. The bads, or what I would like to call rooms for improvements, access to data is a challenge. Distributing the data at the district level where the problems are is a challenge. If you go to the web page of the PBS, you will have a lot of statistics. But most of the statistics are either at the national level or at the provincial level. But the actual needs are at the district level. The data at the district level almost does not exist in the national publications. Also, most of the researchers would like to have access to microdata, what we call it raw data, so that they can run economic models, they can run development models. There is a challenge in providing this data to researchers. Therefore, there is a room for improvement in this, and we are working directly with the PBS and Dr. Naeem Al-Zafar on improving this matter. The achievement of the census 2023 is very important. The endorsement of the census is very important, but I hope next census will be independent so that no endorsement is asked by anybody, and the statistical authority is the only authority that endorse census. Because census in the international experience is a purely development instrument. It's not political. It's not linked with any political process. And I do hope that Pakistan will be able to come at a certain point in time and ensure that the data system is purely technical. And once the data is released, politicians can take it, discuss it, fight over it. This is a different arena and different space that has to be addressed separately from the collection of the data.
In terms of the role of UNFPA in all of this, it sounds very ideal to say we want every pregnancy to be warranted. But in terms of what trepidations the people might have when they look from the outside, they might spark these conspiracy theories about population control, and those ideas might mean different meaning. Those words might have a different meaning for many people. So what would you say to allay the fears of people who are listening who might think that this is a global plan for some population control in Pakistan?
Let me tell you the following. First of all, the word control is out of narrative and should not be on the table. Because control means imposing something on families. Families will not listen to the government. They will not listen to the UN. They will not listen to anybody. When a couple decide to have a baby, they will consult their own conditions. That's a full stop. Whatever you do in terms of the policies, this will not change their ability to have additional baby. And also, it is their own right. Every couple have the absolute right to decide how many kids they want to have. And let me also say that having 240 million in Pakistan is not a problem. Having 250 is not a problem. Having 300 is not a problem. Having 120 is also not a problem. The problem is not the size of the population. The problem is the quality of the population. The literacy rate, the human capital, the skills, the opportunities, young people is able to achieve its potential. Every young girl is able to pursue education. This is where we should care about. UNFPA is working directly with the PBS and with other national institutions to ensure that there is narrative about population that is a human rights based, where while people have the ultimate right to decide how many kids and if they want to have kids in the first place, the government is able to provide the sound information, services in terms of contraceptives, and also the abilities for people to have affordable access to these contraceptives. The challenge in Pakistan when it comes to family planning, for example, because of the service provision needs a lot of improvement. The quality of service when it comes to reproductive health is an issue. Therefore, with the expansion of the reproductive health services, the maternal mortality did not decline.
So don't you feel sometimes these ideas might in practice be contradictory to each other? We do say that every pregnancy should be wanted, childbirth should be safe, people should be free to have as many children as you want. But in practice, the husband's decision might be different from the wife's decision. In a country like Pakistan, where women may not enjoy the same amount of liberty as men do, where we have a patriarchal dominated system, that choice of having a child may not be a free choice for women. So does the problem of that contradiction get solved with awareness, with women emancipation? How does it work in practice?
Well, there are a number of countries who succeeded in this. What, from the international experience, what didn't work is the imposing anything on people. Because once you impose, you'll have people who like and people who do not like. And those who don't like, they start to maneuver. And this ends up, at the long run, in distortion of the population structure. Therefore, a human rights-based is something that you cannot compromise. Second, it is very important for the government and development practitioner to understand their limitations. They cannot decide on behalf of anybody. But what they can do, they can provide information, they can provide services, they can provide consultation, and they can educate. Therefore, for me, if you ask me what is your most important priority in Pakistan, I would say two things. The first one is to invest in girls and women, their capacity, their knowledge, and their opportunities. And the second is to unpack, decompose what is conservative from what is religious. Because today, these are mixed. And when they are mixed, you will not be able, as a development practitioner, to try to say and criticize and question what is mixed between religion and culture. Because once you try, then you will have too many enemies. Now, child marriage is not religious. It's not part of our religion. Honor is not by a Muslim. It's not part of our religion. In the whole Quran, you cannot find the word honor. Honor killing is not part of the religion. This is something that has inherited in the societies, but it is not part of the religion. Beating women is not part of our religion. It is not. Therefore, educating women, if you look at the wives of the Prophet, from them, when Rasul sallallahu alayhi wa sallam said, take two-thirds of your religion from Aisha. So he gave a very high position for the woman. So in Pakistan, you have too many good champion women. In fact, the main maker of UNFPA was a Pakistani woman, Nafees Sadiq. But this is not the mainstream. What's the difference between Benazir Bhutto and any other girl in any province? Benazir Bhutto was given the chance, the opportunity. She was educated. She was coming from family who believed in her capacity. If we are able to make this mainstream, the country will change. So it is very important to invest in the capacities of the women so that they can decide based on their choice, but also their knowledge to know what having more babies, what is the consequences for that on their health, on their ability to pursue their career, on their ability to pursue their well-being, and so on and so forth.
As somebody who has also served as the regional director of the Arab states, I think you're absolutely spot on in terms of a lot of our regressive cultural practices are quasi-religious. They're shown to be religious. They are apparently religious, but they do not come from Islam. They come from cultural practices. But on the ground, they're conflated. So for a lot of people, they might not get that nuance. They might not understand that a lot of our conservative ideas being promoted by the clergy are religious to begin with. So what are some of the unique challenges if you are to compare the experience of Pakistan with your experience in the Arab states?
The experience of Arab states, we have good institutions like Al-Azhar, where Al-Azhar has a pioneering role in fighting FGM, for example, and in fighting female child marriage.
Female genital mutilation.
Yes, and in fighting child marriage as well. Al-Azhar made a number of statements, fatwas, that the issue of having the girl to get married before she is able and ready to do that, he has been very clear about that. In Pakistan, the issue of religion and tribal affairs are mixed together. UNFPA is working with a number of religious groups, and they are really pioneering, but there is a long way to go to this. The specific situation in Pakistan is that it has a very dynamic political life. Therefore, you have too many stakeholders. And many politicians would like to stay in the comfort zone. They don't want to go and speak about social issues rather than keeping an eye on the constituencies because they want to be re-elected again. And I think there is a role for UN agencies and international development practitioners to invest more time with the political parties so that we can find more national champions who will lead the social agenda. If you look at Pakistan's problems, it's not political in the first place. People did not in Pakistan nor in any other country in our region, they challenge the political legitimacy. But always they challenge the quality of services. The social contract between the citizens and the state, when the state fails to provide the minimum of services, dignity, employment, education for people. And once it fails, then young people start to ask, okay, if they are unable to provide this, why should we elect them? Why should we have them ruling the country? And so on and so forth. So I think in Pakistan, there is still a room for improvement. But definitely the political commitment, the real political commitment, and let me be very frank, political commitment is not only narrative. It's not only lip service. It's not only speaking. It's in translating speaking into budget allocations, actions on the ground, allocation of experts, and putting things on the agenda. And let me give you an example. If you look at the population agenda in Pakistan, there is anxiety about that. Almost everybody is anxious about the population, and they feel that we have too many people, we have too many kids, we have too many babies coming every day. But let us come and see what was the actual translation of this anxiety. It's very little. There is no enough allocation of resources for contraceptives. And imagine a country like Pakistan with 240 million that does not manufacture all its contraceptives, still asking to bring contraceptives from outside.
I mean, to be fair, there's very little we manufacture. It's not unique to contraceptives.
So what bigger market you want? These matters needs to move from anxiety to resilience, which means that moving from being anxious about the issue into predicting this issue, analyzing this issue, and make policy response that accommodates the changes and the shifts that are taking place in the population structure in order to transfer the quality of life for people from one stage to another. And let me give you one example. And I have been traveling in all provinces, most of the districts. And while the country doesn't have enough green dollars, tourism is a missed opportunity in the country. The country that has all these assets, different types of weather, different types of natures, magnificent places, but the investment in tourism is very little. And this is one of the missed opportunities. Imagine how this sector, if it is developed, how much will absorb in terms of employment, in terms of bringing foreign currency, and so on and so forth. So I would not like us to focus all the time that we have to reduce the population. No, we have to create opportunities for population. The last report on the 8 billion inhabitants in the earth says exactly, very explicitly, that having 8 billion inhabitants mean 8 billion opportunities, 8 billion opportunities for improvement or for innovation, for having better planet. So it's the issue is not to control the people, but the issue is to provide the utmost opportunity for people to shine, to be able to achieve whatever they want to achieve and to fulfill their potential.
I did have a follow-up on the comparative analysis between countries, but since we are discussing this idea, people might find this hard to digest because oftentimes we're sold the economy versus the population as being in stark contrast to each other. A, is it a complete misnomer? In terms of idealism, it is great to say that if over time Pakistan develops its economic capacity, the population will not be a problem. So if our economic problems are solved, it would not be an issue for us to feed 300 million people or 400 million people. But if we are to say that that might not happen as things stand today, is it still a misnomer to put these things in competition with each other, in opposition to each other? Are you suggesting that there is no link as such between our economic ability to provide and the size of the population?
No. What I am saying is that in terms of strategies, it is not the only strategy to suppress population size. In fact, it is not the good strategy to keep thinking in the numbers. You have to think in the opportunities and the quality. If you have 300 million, and these 300 million are educated, they can work remotely with the whole world. But if you have 100 million who are not educated, they don't have skills, they will be a burden. In UNFPA, we have a trajectory. This trajectory takes the girl of 10 years old. We say, okay, there are two trajectories for this girl. The first one, we keep her at school. We let her finish the education, her education, delay her marriage, provide her opportunity for lifelong education. She can decent work. She can have income. Consequently, she will have fewer number of children. And then she will be contributing positively to the economy. The other trajectory, drop her from school. Immediately she will go to child marriage. She will have too many kids. Her health will be a challenge. And then she will become a burden on her family, on her husband, and on the community. Therefore, it's the issue is not the numbers. Now, there are two circles, the demographic circle and the economic circle. These two circles are linked together. If you look who are the having larger families, you will see are the poorer. And who are having higher human capital are the richer. Because whenever you have some money, you will start thinking naturally how to sustain this. And to sustain this, definitely you will start thinking of the number of goods that you are going to raise. Mm. But if you have nothing, you need help. From where you get this help? I need to have more babies. Therefore, these are linked together. To start with, I guess Pakistan has done a right step last year when convened the population conference on the calibration of resources and population. This is important start. But we should not think all the time to suppress the number of people because these are not the whole story. I am not saying that this is not a problem, but it's not the whole story. And we should not focus all the time on the numbers. We have to focus on the opportunities, expanding the economy, expanding the opportunities for people, invest more in their education because once they are educated, they can find their ways. They can gain make economic gains. But if they are not educated, they will become long life a burden on the economy and on the family.
When we talk in terms of the Arab experience, it might take a long time for us, or we might not even have the political will to build institutions like Al-Azhar. But if we look at countries which may have had a similar experience from ours, especially Bangladesh, they were able to successfully implement family planning programs. What did they get right, or what did countries like Malaysia get right that we might be able to replicate a bit more easily as opposed to the Arab states?
Thank you very much for bringing these two examples. Bangladesh invested in the labor market for women. Most of the industry is on the shoulders of women. which is not the case in Pakistan. Pakistan is labor force participation rate among females is the lowest.
If I may push back on this a little, when we do calculate female participation in labor, we often tend to not include the invisible labor. So, for instance, if the man goes out and cuts the crops and brings them home, it's the wife who will pack the crops once before they go to the market. So there's a lot of invisible participation of women in the labor force, which may not be adequately represented in statistics. Or am I incorrect?
No, you are not correct, unfortunately. The methodology of collecting the labor force participation rate is that the labor force participation rate is that you have employed and unemployed divided by the people in the working age. The employment is defined, and according to the PBS Labor Force Survey, is all those activities that has been done in the week of the survey for wage or for unwaged, unpaid in family business. What is unpaid for other families, it's voluntary. So this is not calculated, but those women who go and work in their own land, this is calculated as part of the labor force participation rate. But those who are outside labor market, or what we call it inactive participants, are those who are not working and they are not looking for a job. And if they were offered a job, they will not take it because either they are discouraged or they know that the level of work is, the level of wages is not enough for them, or they cannot leave their children and so on and so forth. So let me go back to Bangladesh. Bangladesh invested in the economic activity of women. And Malaysia invested in the education. Therefore, both countries made progress. And if you compare Malaysia to Bangladesh, you can see Malaysia done much better than Bangladesh because education is the maker. This is why I said if I have $1 and if I have $1 billion, I will put them in the education of women. Because education is the change maker for the prosperity of Pakistan in the future.
When we say education, it seems like a catch-all word, but doesn't it also matter what that education is? Because if a lot of indoctrination is sold as education in Pakistan, or does the data show that any kind of education, the quality education, may produce better results, but any investment in any kind of education still produces results regardless of the quality of that education?
Education is an ultimate world. Education means formal education, informal education, life skills, educating yourself and educating your girls about their rights, educating the civil rights, the ultimate education needed, the knowledge, to acquire the knowledge about anything you need to make to fulfill your potential. Look at Pakistan. You have 22 million school-age students are out of school. 22 million missed opportunities in Pakistan. Therefore, I think the quality of education is another area that needs to be looked at. I am not expert in that. Mm. I don't have much information about that, but I would assume that this is also an area that needs to be looked at, looking at the fact that there are a number of educated young people who are unemployed because they are unable to compete with in the international market, which means that the education they acquired was not enough to compare to compete with other people from other countries when it comes to the global markets.
But when we make an argument for skill-based education or vocational education, we are making an economic argument as opposed to an emancipatory argument.
Of course, everything. Everything, it's a full package. Mm. Actually, UNFPA and UNICEF and other UN agencies have developed a manual for life skills, which includes starting from expression of yourself, knowing your rights, economic empowerment, livelihood. civil rights, economic rights, sexual reproductive health, how to take care of yourself, how to prevent yourself from STIs, sexual transmitted diseases, and all that stuff. So it's a full package. But we need to believe in our women and girls and to give them opportunity, to give them opportunity to succeed and fail. But without having this, we as parents, you look at us and our kids that who have succeeded. Their life was not full of success. Ups and downs, but we never left our belief that they can make it. So women have been to be given the chance, even if they will not make it from the first time, but they have to be given that. And Pakistan's track record in women who were given chances, it's very good compared with any other nation.
You mentioned sexual and reproductive education. It's mentioned by UNFPA as well. Unfortunately, Pakistan is a country where even the word woman's body translated in Urdu is considered to be a dirty word. And especially words like sexual are a huge taboo in a country like Pakistan. So when you mention sexual and reproductive education, people might have different ideas about what that means. So for them, what is your idea of what entails sexual and reproductive education in a country like Pakistan where these words are such taboo? How do we combat that?
The problem of that it's also the same in Arab. The problem is that we are translating from English. Education in English means transmitting the knowledge. Education in Arabic, and I'm not sure if it's an order as well, is transmitting the knowledge how to do. So sexuality education is translated into Arabic as if we are educating people how to do sex, which is not the case. The sexuality education is the knowledge that is given to young people how to prevent themselves from sexuality transmitted diseases, how to take care of themselves, how to access to the right information. And here I would like to go to another topic that's related to this, which is denying an existence of a problem doesn't mean that we have solved it. If we deny that our young people, I am a father, if we deny the fact that our people are looking for these matters their own way, if we deny this, we are doubling the problem. To sort this problem out, we have to confess that this is something natural. And we have to give our kids the chance to acquire the right information, either from school or from family. Because otherwise, they will take it from their friend, their counterparts, from their friends. And their friends might not have also the access to the right sources of information. Therefore, in my opinion, sexuality education is very important, but it has to go within the culture. It hasn't to break the culture, but it shouldn't be a taboo. Because in a country like Pakistan, if you get the girl get married at early age, she has to be educated before she goes to marriage. How to protect herself, what to know about what is the wrong and the good practices, and so on and so forth. The other point which I would like to mention is another cultural problem that it is in Arab states, and I have seen it in Pakistan, is that the woman's life is a public affair, while man's life is a private affair. If you go to the street, imagine that you are walking in the street and you find a man who's drunk and half naked.
So you saw me last night.
you will say, oh my God, may God help him. And you go. But if you find a woman doing the same, all the neighborhood will come and say, this is haram, let's kill her. Why we have this double standard when we speak about women and men, because we got this slogan of honor, that women have no honor while men have honor. Now, if your sister, any sister, does something not good, your honor is not in a good shape. So you have to revenge to have this. But if you have sex out of marriage with any woman, your sister's honor is not attached. It's not touched. Therefore, these, and all these, and as I said, honor does not exist in the Quran. All these are inherited from the days of Quraysh and transmitted to our generations, but it is not part of our religion. Therefore, we have either to make the life of man and woman a public affair, or we have the life of man and woman a private affair. But you cannot have the life of the woman as a public affair, that anybody has the right to speak how she get dressed, how she behaves, how she speak, how she talk, how she do anything. And you cannot have the same for your male kid. Either we have two public, as it's happening in Europe and in the West, the life of men and women are public affair. Anyone can speak about that. And there are issues that they are private, but both of them are equal in the exposure of the suppression from the society. And until we do that, we'll still have this gap. So this is why I said we need to unpack what is conservative from what religious, because this part is under the conservative thinking of the society. We don't want to break the social norm. We don't want to break the template in which women have been put in, and the template in which the man have put in. When we are coming in the car, Rabia spoke to me about the mental health of men. And she said, in Pakistan, the man even is put in the template. He cannot cry. He cannot express that he is broken. He has always to be seen as strong. He always can be angry. He always can shout. But he cannot show the weakness that every single human being has.
It's intrinsically obvious what the repercussions of gender-based violence is on the person that it's committed against. But if we are to take a macro view of gender-based violence, does the prevalence of gender-based violence in a society affect the entire society in terms of the opportunities that are afforded to women who may not be the direct victims of gender-based violence, but just the prevalence of gender-based violence in that society makes life miserable for all women or all marginalized communities?
Look, first of all, it affects the government negatively, because the cost of gender-based violence is $1 billion. And there have been studies about that. It's very costly for the Ministry of Finance when it comes to the treatment, addressing the clinics that they have to establish, the maintenance that they have to do, the long-term impact. The cost of that on the government, it's very high. And this also, the judicial system, look how much they have to invest in judges and courts and all that stuff. So this is first. Second, it is very negative on the political life in a country which claim or would like to make a dynamic political life. If the woman or the girl cannot speak at house, how we want her to go and make voting in the public affairs? If she is unable to control her body in terms to decide whom to marry and when to marry, what to select in her life, why should she be caring on the public life? So the gender-based violence, in addition to the lifelong impact and pain that women and men, both who are exposed to that, they suffer, but also it's a suffering there for the nation. It's a missed opportunity for the nation. It is suffering for the political life. It is suffering for the treasury in the government, because it's very costly to have a country where gender-based violence is very high. Therefore, it's in the interest of everybody to minimize the prevalence of gender-based violence, because ending this, I would assume, this is not realistic in any society.
In countries like Pakistan, where most domestic violence goes unreported, trying to prevent gender-based violence does not become a problem of policing. Because if it goes unreported, undocumented, it does not even get to the level of the state intervening. So as a society, what are some of the strategies we can employ, or what are some of the strategies that have worked elsewhere to prevent or minimize GBV?
First of all, we have to shame the perpetrator, not to shame the victim. This is the first thing that has to be done. We have to accept the fact that when somebody speaks that I was exposed to violence, that we do not blame the victim. We have to unpack the stigmatization about that. Why victims, women or men, do not report? This is the first question. Either because of stigmatization or because of trust in the entities. Therefore, we have to increase the trust in the entities. How? Educating them about human rights, educating about the confidentiality of these issues, and providing these hotlines, and to ensure that these hotlines are not leaked in terms of information, and to speak up and encourage the speak up. And this is the role of politicians. Politicians has to speak more and more about how ugly gender-based violence is. How ugly, because at the end of the day, who is exposed to this violence? My wife, my daughter, my son, and everybody's family member. So if we care about family, we have to care about the rest of the society. But again, this is another part of the social hypocrisy that we are having. If I look at my daughter, I focus on her rights. If I look about my daughter-in-law, I focus on her duties. And this has also to change. This social hypocrisy, it's not only the political hypocrisy, but we have social hypocrisy because we are looking at men and women differently. We are looking at women, if they belong to us. If it's my daughter, I look at her rights and what space she should be given. And if I look at my daughter-in-law, I would like to see how much she obeys my son, because we are selfish about our issues and about our things.
I think changing societal attitudes and intervening where help is needed go hand in hand. The helpline was a great example. There's also a move towards establishing gender courts. Are there any specific other government intervention programs that you may have worked on, or you may have seen that have worked, which can help alleviate the problem?
Social norm. The international experience assumed that social norm could be changed by women. Therefore, it is very important to invest in their education and their rights. If a woman knows her rights and learn how to defend her rights, the social mode will be broken. Speaking about it in the workshops, in the closed circles among the government and international organizations will not going to change. It will make awareness among these people. The work has to be community-based. We have to invest more in the education, all types of education of women. We have to get aside the impact of grandmamas, because grandmamas are the guards of the social norms. They don't want to break anything. They are the ones who are always focusing, you have to have more kids, because she wants to transfer her life to the new generations. while the whole life has changed. So we have to address grandmamas, we have to address men, of course, because men are not game changers, but they can break the process. They can spoil it. In mathematics, we learned about what is necessary and what is sufficient. So men's education is necessary. It is not sufficient. But women's education is sufficient. Therefore, I think we have to address the whole issue from all angles. Because at the end of the day, it's our families. It's our community. Mm. And we have to see ourselves moving. And if I look at the demographic issues and population affairs issues in Pakistan today, and I compare it with the global agenda, I can see that most of the issues that are discussed in Pakistan have been departed in the world. People now are speaking about low fertility. They are speaking about aging. The other day I was discussing with one of my friends, and he said, Pakistani friends, he said, Alhamdulillah, we don't have problem of aging. People die early. So it's a paradox. It's a paradox. Japan, for example, now they are speaking about what they can do with their aged society, the infertility, the low fertility, the decline of population growth, and so on and so forth. So I think if we don't move very fast to catch up the changes in the society, we will be missed behind, and this is not good for a nation like Pakistan, which is instrumental in the region.
We've talked about the population, we've talked about the women, we've talked about the opportunities that they present to bring the entire discussion together towards the end. The last component of the UNFPA is also the rights, something that we don't talk about enough. Once these children do come into the world, often, especially in Pakistan, prevalent attitudes are children are almost treated like properties, as if they don't have a voice, as if they don't have a right. So when UNFPA does talk about the rights of adolescents, the rights of youths, what does that specifically entail, apart from just the basic human rights?
The rights of adolescents, first right is to continue their education, not to be exposed to child marriage. The rights not to be exposed to FGM. This, alhamdulillah, does not exist in this country. Their right to live with dignity, not to be exposed to violence. The right to decide on their future. I want to be a doctor, I want to be an engineer, I want to be a musician. Whatever, all these rights, the right to know about everything, starting from the reproductive right to the civil rights, political rights, all these rights, the right to know, the right to live, the right to enjoy the development, all these rights apply. Let me just say something that which is very close to my heart. In all my experience in the developing countries, always we speak as if we are born with less rights than any other nation. All humans are born with the same rights. But it is up to the society what rights ask or give to their generation to enjoy. In my opinion, we have to give our generations all their rights. Now, how to enjoy their rights? Of course, subject to the culture, subject to the religion. Nobody is advocating for breaking this, but we have to ensure that they can decide, they can select, they can get access to information, they can live with full dignity. Otherwise, how we would like them to be leaders? If you suppress a kid for a number of years, and then you want him or her to be a leader, the personality is formed at this age. And the story of Pakistan as a nation is inspiring. It was born like an idea in the head of a leader, and this leader decided to make it happen. And it happened. So this gives us the opportunity to think that there is unlimited, there is no ceiling for thinking. There is no ceiling for dreaming. And people are always able to do miracles if they are given a chance.
That's such a beautiful thought to end this on. And I know you're running a tight schedule. You promised us an hour. We've already gone over that. Thank you so much for your thoughts. And from all the people of Pakistan, the most we can do is our love, our prayers are for you, for your family, and for all the people of Palestine. Thank you so much, sir, for your time. Would you like to leave the people of Pakistan with a message?
Thank you very much. Let me say that when I arrived to Pakistan, I felt I'm in my home, literally. I have been surrounded by love, respect, and I wish in my bottom of heart that this nation goes rise up and up, and to see all the all what I'm saying here. And sometimes my colleagues know that I am direct, and I say things as they are, because really I love this country and I love these people. So let me wish all Pakistanis the best luck and the best prosperity in the future.
And from the people of Pakistan, we love you and we love your country. Thank you so much for your time. And thank you everybody for listening. Take care.
Thank you very much.